VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. The U.S. Justice Department is asking federal judges to dismiss two cases against President-elect Donald Trump. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The department is abandoning both its election interference and classified documents cases against Trump. Department prosecutors are citing long-standing guidance that a sitting president cannot be prosecuted. And right, the Constitution requires the cases be dismissed before Trump is inaugurated. Both moves were expected after Trump's election win, and his spokesman calls them a major victory for the rule of law. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Israeli airstrikes are hitting Lebanon as negotiations progress toward a ceasefire between the country and Lebanon-based Hezbollah militants. Lebanon reported that at least 31 people were killed Monday as explosions lit up the sky and airstrikes hit targets in Beirut and in Tyre, a southern port city. Israeli troops launched the ground invasion of Lebanon in October after about a year of exchanging low-level attacks across the Israel-Lebanon border with Iran-backed Hezbollah militants. More than 3,700 people have since been killed and 1.2 million displaced. The fighting has amplified worries about direct conflict between Israel and Iran. International mediators are seeking to broker a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah to end the fighting. The proposal under discussion to end the fighting calls for an initial 2-month ceasefire. A top Hamas official in Lebanon said the Palestinian militant group would support a ceasefire between its ally Hezbollah and Israel. This is VOA News. New research finds the number of people killed in Sudan's civil war is far higher than previously thought. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Sudan's civil war erupted in April 2023, a brutal power struggle between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. An estimate widely used by international aid agencies said just over 20,000 civilians had died from the violence in the first 14 months of the war. But a new study from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine looked at multiple sources and suggests the death rate is much higher. Maysoon Dahab is lead author of the report.
In the first 14 months of the war, there has been a 50% increase in the death rate in Khartoum State alone. That amounts to about 61,000 deaths due to disease, starvation, and directly from the violence itself. Amongst that 61,000, we have about 26,000 who have been killed directly by violence.
The United Nations says the conflict has forced 11 million people to flee their homes, with some 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, needing food aid, making it the world's biggest hunger crisis. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Scuffles and fistfights broke out between ruling party and opposition lawmakers in Serbia's parliament on Monday over a deadly rail station roof collapse that has ignited tensions in the Balkan state. The opposition wanted to discuss who was responsible for the crash that killed 15 people in the northern city of Novi Sad on November 1st. The collapse has fueled widespread anger toward the government and protests, becoming a flashpoint for broader dissatisfaction with Serbia's authoritarian rule. The fifth and final round of negotiations for a global plastics treaty began on Monday. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Negotiators are gathering in Busan, South Korea, in what's billed as a final push to address the global crisis of plastic pollution. Opening the talks, Inga Andersen, who leads the UN Environment Programme, says the world needs an end to plastic production.
Not a single person on this planet wants to witness plastic litter in green spaces, on their streets, or washing up on their shores.
The planet is choking on plastic, according to the UN, polluting lakes, rivers, oceans, and people's bodies. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Namibians vote in presidential elections tomorrow, Wednesday.
We have sell our manifesto. People are reacting. People want to vote. People want change. And we believe that change is exactly going to come, and Namibia will not be the same. So we are ready to go to the polls, hoping that the Electoral Commission of Namibia is also very ready.
A new study says the death toll from Sudan's brutal civil war far exceeds the previous estimates. Analysts say the sinking of migrant boats off the Madagascar coast highlight the desperation of many Somalis. A Zambian opposition leader endorses President Hakainde Hichilema's election. The U.S. urges Zimbabwe to double down on reforms.
We need public officials to quit using their public offices for private gain. We need the judiciary to be able to deliver justice independently of political considerations. And we need Zimbabweans' rights to assembly and free speech to be fully respected.
And Special Counsel Jack Smith moves to dismiss Donald Trump's 2020 election interference and classified document cases. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Namibia is preparing for its seventh presidential and national assembly elections since gaining independence 34 years ago, with the ruling SWAPO party facing potential shifts in support. The November 27 election marks a milestone as SWAPO fields its first female presidential candidate, Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, who could become Africa's third female president. The key question is whether SWAPO can recover from its loss of a two-third parliamentary majority in the last election and retain its long-held power. Vitalio Angula has the story from Windhoek.
Coming off the back of its most disappointing showing since Namibia attained independence in 1990, the ruling party, SWAPO, is hoping to cement its position leading the government when the country holds elections on Wednesday. SWAPO, which has ruled Namibia since independence, lost in 2019 its two-thirds majority in parliament, which is needed to pass laws. Kadiva Hamutumwa is the president of the Namibia Exile Kids Association, NECA, an affiliate of the ruling party. She says the party has done enough work to regain its majority.
Throughout the 40 regions, as we were traveling explaining this manifesto, people exported, they had understood the achievements that the SWAPO party has gained. They had equally understood the challenges that they've had. But there was low democracy that is growing as a nation that has also changed.
The most recent census places Namibia's estimated population at just over 3 million. Of those, 1.4 million are registered voters. Many parties in recent weeks have been hard at work mobilizing voters, mostly made up of young people, to cast their votes. Manuel Ngaringombe is a Secretary General of the People's Democratic Movement, or PDM, which is the official opposition in the country.
We have sold our manifesto. People are reacting. People want to vote. People want change. And we believe that change is exactly going to come, and Namibia will not be the same. So we are ready to go to the polls, hoping that the Electoral Commission of Namibia is also very ready.
Earlier this month, members of the police and defense force who will be on duty on voting day cast their votes across the country. Namibians in the diaspora also voted, with results showing a lead for SWAPO. New parties taking part in their maiden elections, the Independent Patriots for Change, or IPC, and the Affirmative Repositioning, AR, movement came second and third respectively. Job Amupanda is the leader of the AR movement. He applauded the Electoral Commission of Namibia for peaceful elections, free from violence and intimidation.
We actually think that those people who fight are very primitive, and we haven't had that experience. Do we want to compare it to other countries? And we see what is happening in Mozambique, and we can't guarantee what's going to happen.
21 political parties are vying for seats in the National Assembly. 15 candidates are vying for the country's presidency. Among those vying for the presidency is Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah, the only female candidate on the ballot and the ruling party's candidate, who will become Africa's third female head of state if SWAPO retains its long-held position of ruling party. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
The number of people killed in Sudan's civil war is far higher than previously thought, according to new research. The conflict has forced 11 million people to flee their homes and created the world's worst hunger crisis. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Khartoum's residential streets are lined with hundreds of graves. Cemeteries have run out of space. Abdin Khidir is an undertaker in Omdurman, a western district of Khartoum.
The numbers of dead became really big. We bury at least 50 people per day. These are all fresh bodies.
Sudan's civil war erupted in April 2023, a brutal power struggle between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. An estimate widely used by international aid agencies said just over 20,000 civilians had died from the violence in the first 14 months of the war. But a new study from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine looked at multiple sources and suggests the death rate is much higher. Maysoon Dahab is lead author of the report.
In the first 14 months of the war, there has been a 50% increase in the death rate in Khartoum State alone. That amounts to about 61,000 deaths due to disease, starvation, and directly from the violence itself. Amongst that 61,000, we have about 26,000 who have been killed directly by violence.
Separately, the aid group Doctors Without Borders says that since January this year, one in six of its patients at a Khartoum hospital were children under 15. Many sustained severe injuries from gunshots, blasts and shrapnel. There's also been a rise in cases of severe malnutrition among children. The United Nations says the conflict has forced 11 million people to flee their homes, with some 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, needing food aid, making it the world's biggest hunger crisis. It's vital that more is done to end the suffering, says Dahab.
So in the case of the international community, ensuring the understanding that aid efforts need to be increased, scaled, and put out to inaccessible populations. In terms of actors who are shaping the war, what we hope to put out in terms of the research is the true price of this war, so that they are able to make their decision based on those facts.
The United States Special Envoy for Sudan, Thomas Perriello, traveled to Khartoum last week for talks with Sudan's army chief.
We also share the aspiration for this war to end as soon as possible, to see an end to the horrific atrocities.
There are few signs that either the Sudanese army or the Rapid Support Forces are ready to agree a truce. Meanwhile, Russia last week vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire, saying the process excluded Sudan itself. Britain, which sponsored the resolution alongside Sierra Leone, labeled Moscow's veto a disgrace. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
The United States is urging the Zimbabwe government to double down on reforms aimed at returning the country to the prosperity it once enjoyed. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe, where negotiations on clearing the country's $21 billion debt had been with the African Development Bank.
Speaking to reporters in Harare on Monday, Pamela Tremont, the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe, said her country wants to have cordial relations with the Southern African nation. She urged the government to pursue political and financial reforms that she said would deliver Zimbabwe's people the prosperity and dignity they deserve.
We're here today as part of our commitment to the Zimbabwean people that is long-standing and consistent, and we're here to advocate for the reforms that the international community has been asking for many years. We need public officials to quit using their public offices for private gain. We need the judiciary to be able to deliver justice independently of political considerations, and we need Zimbabweans' rights to assembly and free speech to be fully respected.
Tremont spoke as talks on restructuring Zimbabwe's $21 billion debt began. Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank, called for negotiations on the debt to speed up.
It is fairly time to bring these to a close and the decades of untold damage to the economy of Zimbabwe, the suffering of its people, and have a new beginning with collective hope, aspiration, and shared prosperity for its people today and well into the future. It is time to make Zimbabwe beautiful again. No one, no matter how strong, can run up a hill carrying a big pack or piles of sand on their back.
The $21 billion debt of Zimbabwe, of which the bulk, I must say, is actually arrears, has made arrears the new debt, like stacks, piles of sandbags on the back of Zimbabwe. Now, we all agree we must play our part to correct this anomaly and give a new lease of life to this nation.
Adesina was asking institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to finance new loans for Zimbabwe and forgive or reduce old debts. At the same meeting, President Emmerson Mnangagwa appealed for debt to be restructured so Zimbabwe can access credit lines.
The successful implementation of arrears debts in the debt resolution strategy is key for Zimbabwe to unlock new concessional external financing, critical for achieving our economic development objectives. I call for the continued support of international financial institutions, developing partners, our credit lines, and international communities for the arrears, arrears, and debt resolution process. Access to external concessional financing will be key for long-term funding of our projects and programs.
Zimbabwe's national debt has climbed steadily since the early 2000s, when land confiscations by the government led to sharply reduced food production and sent the economy into a tailspin. Some government officials maintain that Zimbabwe cannot access credit lines because of the targeted sanctions imposed on some leaders for alleged election rigging and human rights abuses in the early 2000s. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barkey in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 26th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In Zambia, the leader of the opposition party for National Unity and Progress, also known as PNUP, has endorsed President Hakainde Hichilema's re-election bid. Havi Hamududu, a former parliamentarian and presidential candidate, says Hichilema's economic policy is the core reason for the endorsement. It comes as opposition groups accuse the government of failing to resolve the energy crisis and tough economic conditions, including the high cost of living. But Hamududu tells viewers Peter Clotty that Zambians will soon begin to see the benefits of President Hakainde Hichilema's policies.
Hakainde Hichilema, the current president of UPND, is doing some economic reforms that give hope for the eventual economic recovery of our country. He has managed to restructure our foreign debt, which was taking away the fiscal space for the government to undertake its functions. If the debt was not structured, our national budget basically would be to pay debt. We had reached a point where over 50% of our budget could have been going to debt servicing.
Talking about the economy, a lot of Zambians have been complaining that things have gotten very expensive and that the president promised that mealy meal, which is a staple for all Zambians, will be cut into half or less than half. But it has more than doubled or tripled, and people are saying he has failed in his promises. How do you respond to that?
That is more of a political debate than the economic one, because whoever won the elections, the cost of living was going to go up, because one of the cost pushers is the debt. You know, Zambia's economy is an import-dependent economy. And when you have a huge debt, there is a lot of pressure for foreign exchange to save the debt than to run government functions. So whoever had won the elections, the debt itself was going to make it difficult to bring down the cost of living.
Some of your critics are accusing you of playing tribal politics by deciding to even not to compete and to endorse him over a year ahead of the election. How do you respond to that?
Looking at some of the policy reforms that he's undertaking,
I think we have to be courageous enough to endorse way ahead of time than to endorse opportunistically when things look up. I'm an economist by training, and I know what will happen in the next 18 months or 24 months. One, debt restructuring has been done, easing the fiscal, and therefore government now has the fiscal space to do the things that they are supposed to do. Secondly, in the mining sector, which was really going down because the mining companies were beginning to disinvest because of the adverse policies and taxes around the mining, they have now put a very attractive mining fiscal regime that is attracting investment. A lot of mines are expanding, new mines are opening up. The import of that very soon will have increased the mineral production and exports, which will invariably lower the exchange rate.
Haibi Hamududu is the leader of the opposition party for the National Unity and Progress Party of Zambia. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. The Somali government says it will begin evacuating the survivors of two boats carrying mostly Somali migrants, which capsized off the coast of Madagascar on Saturday. 24 passengers were killed while 46 others survived. As Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu, the passengers were attempting to migrate in search of a better life away from Somalia's chronic drought, violence, and food insecurity.
During a news briefing in Mogadishu, Somali Foreign Minister Ahmed Maalim Fiqi confirmed the fatality figures from the capsizing of the two boats off the coast of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean on Saturday. Fiqi said that while authorities believe most of the migrants are Somalis, they suspect that a small number are from other countries. He said migrants identified as Somalis will be brought back to their home country. He says, we have made significant efforts over the past 2 days, particularly through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and their embassy staff in Addis Ababa. They have maintained close communication with their headquarters and the office of the president. Together, they have worked effectively to determine the best way to evacuate these survivors after assessing the nationalities of those involved. Migration from Somalia has been on the rise in recent years, mainly due to a lack of security and lack of employment opportunities in the country. There are no reliable estimates of how many have migrated. Zakaria Yusuf Abdirahman, program manager of the Coalition of Somalia Human Rights Defenders, says many Somali youths have a sense of hopelessness that drives them to seek opportunities elsewhere, even if it means facing dangerous conditions. He says that with the ongoing insecurity and employment challenges in the country, the burdens people face continue to increase daily. He also says there seems to be no end in sight, and this situation particularly affects the youth who are striving for a better life and future. Some Somali lawmakers accuse the government of failing to create opportunities for younger people under 30 years old, who make up 75% of the population. Mohamed Ibrahim Maalimu, an opposition member of parliament, says young Somalis should try to make their country a better place rather than flee. The lawmaker says he understands why young people are leaving the country. He believes that the insecurity caused by terrorism and the lack of employment opportunities are significant challenges contributing to their disappointment with their homeland. However, he encourages them to recognize that they have the power to create change in their country. Meanwhile, dozens of Somalis who left and got as far as Madagascar are preparing to come back, no doubt happy to be alive after the boat sinking, but no closer to migrating from the country they desperately wanted to leave. Mohamed Sheikh Noor, for VOA News, Mogadishu.
Human Rights Watch says Mozambique security forces have killed at least 10 children and injured dozens of others while trying to suppress weeks of protest following a disputed presidential election. The rights group says hundreds of other minors have been detained by security forces in violation of international law.
The Associated Press reports that the Southern African country has been beset by unrest after the ruling party's candidate was declared the winner of the October 9 election. Opposition parties claimed the vote was rigged, and international observers, including a team from the European Union, criticized the conduct of the election. U.S. prosecutors on Monday asked a U.S. judge to drop the criminal cases against accusing President-elect Donald Trump of seeking to overturn his 2020 election defeat and unlawfully withholding classified documents, citing his impending return to the presidency following his successful 2024 campaign. For analysis, viewers Scott Waterman and Laurie London spoke with Professor Harold Krent of Kent College of Law.
Well, he's asked President Trump to be dismissed from both cases, but the documents case will continue because there are other defendants in that case, and there's an important legal issue that's on appeal, namely whether or not the Attorney General violated the Appointments Clause by appointing a special counsel, and that if the special counsel is an officer of the United States, then the Senate must be able to consent or advise on the appointment. So that issue is still live. That issue will continue. And indeed, President Trump, alleged co-conspirator, will still possibly stand trial in a documents case. But as for January 6th, Jack Smith bowed to the longtime Department of Justice policy that there be no prosecutions of a sitting president, no matter how grave. And so we ask that the case be dismissed, and it is very, very unlikely to be revived even after a four-year term in office.
They did file papers in the Palm Beach case asking the case to stay on appeal, but they did withdraw Donald Trump from the suit.
It's a consistent policy in both cases. The special counsel decided to his actions with DOJ precedent and decided to dismiss President Trump from both cases. That doesn't suggest that we've seen the end of this. Jack Smith is likely to write a full report, perhaps some kind of information excised in terms of privilege, but full report about what he viewed the evidence in the case and presumably how damning it was against the current, well, president-to-be.
What happens to all the other people that are involved, been either charged or already serving time as far as this case goes?
So Jack Smith's move does not affect either the indictments against other individuals for the insurrection on January 6th, nor does it affect the people who have been convicted of the attempted obstruction of the ballot counting on that day. However, President Trump has said that he will likely pardon those or most of those who engaged in the insurrection on January 6th. So that's to be seen. And he has the power then to order the Attorney General, or to request the Attorney General, to dismiss the indictments of those that are pending.
That's Professor Harold Krent of Kent College of Law speaking with viewers Scott Waterman and Laurie London. And that's it for this Tuesday, November 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington.
Presents the latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries. Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.